Tom Athanasio, welcome to KABU.
Good to be here. How are you doing today?
Good. Tom Athanasio founded and directs Eco Equity, whose principal goal is justice for the poor within an emergency global climate mobilization, which he hopes to live to see. He speaks and writes a lot, including the book Divided Power, The Ecology of Rich and Poor, and he's now writing on his third book on justice and transformation in the greenhouse century. Tom Athanasio, I talked to you a couple of weeks ago about Trump pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Accords. Since 1999, you've been agitating and evaluating and writing at the many international meetings on how to stop climate change catastrophe. You've concluded that the Trump pullout was, in fact, all things considered, good, in that had this country stayed, it would have done what so many business interests in the U.S., particularly big oil and coal, wanted to do, which is not to slow down the international effort, but also get the world body to approve their proposals, that is, clean coal, clean oil, carbon sequestrations, approve them as legitimate methods of reducing emissions. And that, of course, would then lead to the countries getting the green light and approval to spend a lot of money for research and model building and give it to those same companies. Anyway, in the wake of the Trump pullout, the Chinese and Europeans, in fact, a number of countries affirmed their support for the Paris Accords, that they would stay in and committed to take meaningful steps. So, Tom, what are the chances they will take meaningful steps, and particularly take meaningful steps to assist the exploited poor and most vulnerable countries of the global south?
First of all, I want to say that the U.S. will still be attending the meetings, and so there's still going to be lots of opportunities for the Trump administration to gum up the works. So that's something that's going to be an ongoing trench battle that is going to continue to unfold. What are the possibilities that the countries of the world will actually pivot to a more explicitly fair transition architecture? And are those chances better with the U.S. being out? That is an excellent, excellent question. And I have to say that I'm sorry this is radio, but the answer isn't simple. I mean, the fact that the U.S., which is by far the wealthiest country in the world, will not be participating in any support regime for the developing countries and the most vulnerable countries and the countries that want to leapfrog to a 100% renewable economy. The fact that the U.S. won't be doing its share to assist that transition is certainly not going to make it easier for other countries to step up. At the same time, it's very, very clear that the catastrophe of the Trump administration has motivated a lot of countries, including the Chinese and the Europeans in particular, to take a more forceful leadership roles. So we don't really know what's going to happen. What we do know is that the world is mobilized, and hopefully that will make a big difference. You got to remember that what happens at the international level is only a reflection of what happens at the nation-state level and what happens at the local level. That said, it's extremely important, but still, it's only a reflection.
You know, before we talk about what specifically should be done and the sequence of things that should be done and the technologies that show the most promise for fairly rapidly moving towards the climate greenhouse gas emission numbers and concentrations that would at least greatly reduce climate change and global warming. The Chinese are taking credit now for sort of leading the revolution towards renewable energy, and they surely have through investing tremendous sums of money in the production processes for solar and to some extent wind turbines. They've really lowered the costs and they're almost cornering the market. They're so cheap. The Germans can barely compete and the U.S. manufacturers have trouble competing as well. What do you make of the Chinese? Are they going to move? They're now the greatest polluters on Earth, though, in addition to, of course, the greatest producers of solar panels. What about the Chinese and Europeans? Do they show signs of actually doing things versus paper and word commitments?
Yeah, this is always the big question is, who's moving the fastest? Are they moving fast enough? Who's moving the slowest? why, what would it take to get them moving faster? And it's always the big question, and it's a complicated question, but I think the simple answer is that the Chinese are doing a tremendous amount, and they're having transition problems. Like, for example, they have got more wind online than they have grid to move the wind electricity around. They promised to get on top of that, and they're shutting down their dirtiest coal plants. But on the other hand, they're investing in clean coal. They're building out a huge amount of solar, but they're also building a huge amount of nuclear, so which we might or might not agree with. So it's a complicated situation, but the short answer is that the Chinese are taking climate very, very seriously. And I also just have to say that, yes, it is true that China is the largest polluter on the planet, but it is not the largest polluter on a per capita basis. And so that's always very important to be clear about this. We still do a lot more damage per person.
Yeah, and in fact, it could fairly easily be avoided just through a number of different conservation measures. Those are the lowest hanging fruit, and they could really make a difference.
I'd like to say one thing else about China, which is really interesting, which is that the central government in China is the political actor that's supporting the transition and driving the transition. It's really the opposite of what's going on in the United States, where local people and state governments are driving the transition, and the national government is doing everything in its power to stop the solar transition and to continue the reign of fossil fuel capital. So it's very interesting. It's a very interesting political situation. What's happening is that people are asking now in China, is the central government strong enough to pull this off, given the fact that there's so much resistance from, say, provincial power structures and provincial elites, many of which are really, really rooted in coal. So it's a hugely interesting situation when you compare the U.S. and China and the political challenges of making the transition that we need to make.
Tom, let's switch gears and talk about climate justice. Earlier we spoke and you pointed out there has to be a sequencing. Tell us about that. What would be required for climate justice and gaining that support all over the world? If it's not seen as fair, it's not going to happen, as you pointed out. Tell us your story.
You know, in the United States, when we hear the terms climate justice, we think about fence-line communities, and we think about the poor being choked by fumes. And there's a rapidly expanding climate justice agenda, but basically we think about it in those kinds of terms. When you're thinking about climate justice from the global perspective, the picture and the challenges look really different, and you have to spotlight the fact that some parts of the world are much, much richer and have much more historical capacity, has much more historical responsibility, and much more financial and technological capacity to meet the challenges of the transition. So it's a different set of climate justice problems. But it's interesting that it, both the local level and the global level, it's true that if the transition is not fair and not embraced by people for their own self-interest to better their own lives, it's not going to happen, or at least it's not going to happen fast enough. We're talking, after all, about a transition that's historically unprecedented. We have to eliminate carbon-based fuels in a very, very short period of time, shorter than one human lifetime, which, as you know, is very short. And we've never done anything like this. And to imagine that we're going to be able to pull it off in a world where the richest 1% of the human population owns, as it now does, more than everyone else, is just foolishness. It's simply not going to happen. The bottom line is that climate is a global problem. It's a global commons problem. And it can only be solved if each actor, in this case nation states, sees the other actors to be doing their best to do their fair share. So justice is a first tier issue at the level of fair shares. Who's pulling their own weight? That same issue, not coincidentally, is at the absolute forefront of class politics and economic justice politics at the level of local communities. We have to find ways forward that yield very, very rapid technological and infrastructural change while at the same time lifting up the poor and protecting the vulnerable. And that challenge takes different forms in different countries, and it takes different forms at the local level and at the global level, but it's the same challenge.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Tom Athanasio. We're talking about climate justice and the way in which the vast changes in the way we produce energy and use energy, and in fact, the way we live, have to be made. Tom, you pointed out the considerable differences in how states are going to have to change. It seems to me, though, there are some common themes, which I think you agree with, that localities, especially, of course, in the poor world, as you pointed out, want to leap way ahead in going to 100% renewable energy fairly quickly. The quickest and easiest ways to produce clean energy is not to have to build huge grids everywhere, highly secure, extremely expensive, environment-destroying themselves, and vulnerable to attack, but in fact, local energy of many kinds. The sun is shining all over the world. The wind blows. We have the capacity now and the technology right now, it seems to me, to change production and especially energy production very radically and very quickly. Worker skills are certainly sufficient. In the United States, we have an abundance of those skills that would be necessary for both small-scale utility, but for producing local energy. Some big facilities, of course, on the outskirts and sometimes in the cities, but many, many smaller facilities, all of them connected in local grids. Tell us about that. And in the poor world, in fact, in the big cities, that would also be true, and every village could be electrified fairly easily with not too much money. Anyway, that's my hypothesis. Tell us about it.
That's absolutely true. To a first order, what we're talking about is a very rapid transition to a net zero carbon global economy. For many of us, that means a 100% renewables economy. And renewables are everywhere. They're ubiquitous. They're spread around the planet. And in a 100% renewables economy, there's much less need to ship photons, electrons, large distances, right? We just don't need the same kind of grid. So local energy production, whether wind or geothermal or tidal or direct solar photovoltaic, should be maximized. And we need a grid which is extremely resilient and extremely decentralized. That said, there are challenges which the local energy people don't always take seriously. One of them is the load management issues that come up at the level of nations and continents. But that is a challenge that we can solve. Another one is the fact that we are becoming a highly urban society. By 2050, 70% of the human population is going to be living in cities, and we want this to take place so that we can rewild the countryside and give some space to the animals, right? And that means that we have to be able to provide concentrated 24/7, 365 energy to huge cities. And that means we have to deal with some very, very heavy metal issues. So it's a complicated issue. I mean, if you really drill down on this, Bill, and you're technically minded, there's very little that's more interesting than the debates that are going on about grid architectures going forward, because they have to do with city rural issues and democracy issues and local control over regional control. It's fantastic. It's the kind of problem we want to have, right? And that's the main thing to remember. This is a solvable problem. It's the kind of problem we want to have.
Yeah, the storage problem is a major one, of course, but that can be solved. I mean, we're on our way. For certain.
Absolutely.
It's just
Absolutely.
It's a matter of money, basically, and not of whether our technologies have to be that improved?
We basically have the technologies. We need to scale them up and deploy them globally, right. But we basically have them.
Yes, and do it in a just manner, which is not that expensive, actually. When you look at the world production capacity and the amount of wealth as measured by being able to produce things, it's enormous. We have so many shuttered factories. We have the resources. It can be done in an environmentally sustainable manner. It seems to me it's all possible. In the George Bush, the first phrase, to change it a little bit, we really have the wallet. What we don't have is the political will.
Yes, we certainly have the money. We're talking about large, large sums of money when we're talking about saving human civilization. But I always like to use the following thought experiment. Say it costs $1 trillion a year to save human civilization for 50 years. So say the bottom line bill was $50 trillion. Would it be worth it?
That's a good question. I want my bank account to stay high, says our elites, regardless.
Bill, it's a distributional issue. We have the money, we have the technology mostly, but you know, the fact of the matter is that there's going to be winners and losers. And so it's the same situation with the climate transition as it is with the fate of democracy. If we don't deal with the fact that the rich have all the money and the rich have all the power, we're not going to make the transition. It really is as simple as that. And the good news is that people know it. The good news is that people really, really know it, and that the catastrophe of the Trump victory, the perfect storm that led to Mr. Trump becoming the nominal president of the United States, has really focused people's minds.
I think in our last interview, you and we conclude this way, Donald Trump could well be our best organizer. So keep at it, Donald, although he has his hand on the trigger as well. And he could.
Yeah, he has his hand, his other little hand.
Yes, he could all, and he has so many little hands on so many things, and he could do enormous harm, particularly to poor people here and around the globe. But that's another matter. We'll talk again. Thanks a lot, Tom Athanasio. Thanks for talking to us. Why don't we pitch your books, Divided Planet, The Ecology of Rich and Poor. What's your second book?
Dead Heat, Global Justice and Global Warming, but they're both pretty old, and I'm working on a new one.
And Tom does not want to give up his title. He's afraid someone else would steal it, but the subtitle will be Justice and Transformation in the Greenhouse Century.
Something like that. Yes,
something
that's
like
right.
That. Tom Athanasio, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Yeah, good to talk to you, Bill.
Right, so long.
I just blowed in and I got them Dust Bowl blues. I just blowed in and I got them Dust Bowl blues. I just blowed in and I'll blow back out again.